this one American.
Oh, I haven't yet.
One American News has that like Asian lady at like White House press conferences that always just asks like everybody else is like, so what about the kids at the border? What's going on with fucking COVID? And she's just like, how does it feel to be like such a great president? And then he's like, great question. And like every like
thank you. Just coming out there with the softball, you know.
One American,
just hitting you with it.
Not that's not you gotta go Newsmax. That's when you get rougher. Newsmax is that's like even lower production value, but like
okay.
But Newsmax is more geared for like I have a brother who works on Wall Street. And I own a pool cleaning business in Staten Island. Yes, I'm racist, but everybody I know is racist.
Okay.
Like, it's like Staten Island, like,
it's very insulated. I would prefer it, like, the lower the production quality, I think the more I trust. You know, I'm trying to listen to the news where it's just, like, two dudes podcasting in a garage somewhere because they don't have basements, or if they do have basements, it's an illegal basement, and they're just sitting here just like laying down these truths about how you can't trust the media, you can only trust these two guys.
Here's the thing,
you know,
if those guys didn't, so basically what you're describing is how Alex Jones started, so
You gotta start somewhere, you know, you gotta start small, right?
I mean, look, I was listening to this podcast the other day, and they're like, if Alex Jones are like people who are like, yo, you can't trust any news source. If those people didn't exist, the CIA or an intelligence agency would create those people.
Would have created them.
Because,
yeah. It's
because
kind of crazy.
Disinformation agents. That's like a lot.
Yeah.
Just that's it. Like, you understand how powerful that fucking is. You understand how powerful it is. Go outside and see all the people not wearing masks.
Yeah,
because they're pussy.
Yeah,
what do you
like,
mean?
Whoa, I'm not a little. Yeah, no. The CIA is just looking at all these agencies and just being like, "Oh, looks like we didn't have to
they
do.
Have
it.
To
looks
shit.
Like they did it. They did it for us. This is great. You know, it's very rare that this works out like this. Holy shit!
It would be the CIA or like one of those weird economic shadowy, like the Bilderberg Group, like just weird. And you wonder how I know these things because I'm a YouTube baby and I've been on YouTube forever and I've been YouTubing
right
deep
on,
in them
man.
Holes. I just follow 25 channels of a dude named Hotep Sam. Who just tells me about how there are no white people.
Hey,
it's an optical illusion
brought
to you by Mars,
right,
which is in retrograde. That's
okay. Hey, you know, ask him if he wants to be on.
Yeah.
I would love to get to know.
I would love to get history from
Hotep Sam.
Hotep Sam, who is surprisingly white. That's the craziest thing. He's just a white guy named Hotep Sam.
Okay, whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. Not what I was expecting.
Okay.
Hey, how's it going?
Hotep Sam.
We got a...
One of our listeners, who is a Hotep, his name is Sam, is a white man who lives in Virginia. All right, Henry, so who are we studying today?
We got to get started. Holy shit. All right. We're looking at next guy in the Cold Warriors series we're looking at is Nikita Khrushchev, the man himself.
Big dog.
He's like, yeah, man, he was really short. He was like 5'1 and 200 pounds.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just like looking at these pictures of him. And he, like, man, he was cute.
What do you
like,
know about Nikita Khrushchev?
I want a little.
Like, what did you know about before studying him?
I knew he came after Stalin.
You knew he came
before
after Stalin?
Studying him. I knew he came after Stalin. I knew he denounced Stalin, and I knew that he did the fucking, or he like, not financed, he caused the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Okay.
That's about the extent of, and he built the Berlin Wall, but that was the extent of my Nikita knowledge.
I just,
what about you?
I just know him from that one movie, The Death of Stalin, which is a great movie.
Yeah, we had Steve Buscemi,
he's
man.
Yeah, played by Steve Buscemi.
Yep.
Just intense, it's like if you took like two funerals in a, what's the name of that fucking movie? Anyway, it's a great movie.
In a wedding,
two funerals in a wedding, right? You took that and then you put it over the death of Stalin. That's what, that's that movie. And it's amazing.
It's a pretty. Yeah, I like that movie a lot. We got Khrushchev. He was born April 17th of 1894. So he's a 19th century baby, you know, and then like heading into the 20th, which is kind of weird because he was like 6 years old and then he was on the cusp of a new century. He's born in Kalinovka, Russia.
Weren't you born on the cusp of a new
century? Yeah, 96.
Yeah.
96. So that's what I'm kind of hinting at.
Yeah. You know, you're saying you and Khrushchev are the same guy?
Yeah, man. Okay. We're buddies. Okay. It was being a past life. Kalinovka, Russia is like kind of southeast of Moscow, so it's kind of right on the border of modern Ukraine. Mm. And his family is dirt poor, like so poor, like stereotypically peasant Russian poor, drinking cabbage water like in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And just to show you how poor they were, like his father wanted
him. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Cabbage water, it's like it's like really bad soup, I guess, is you just dip cabbage leaves in the water and you know that scene of Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory where he's like, I'm sick of cabbage water, because you know you just get you dip the cabbage in the broth of the water.
That sounds
water, whatever.
Awful.
Yeah, no, they're just like really not eating well. to give you an idea about how poor they were, his father wanted him to be a cobbler so he would always have a pair of shoes. Like, that was his father's aspiration for, I hope you make shoes so you can always have a pair.
That's
not setting your aims high,
that's as poor as it gets. There is no other.
That's real sad.
Yeah, there is no other poor. Like, that's like, hey, I want you to be a cow so you'll eat beef one day. I don't,
Just not very, but I mean, Khrushchev would prove him wrong. He would exceed his father's wildest expectations. So in 1908, they moved to Yuzovka, which is now the city of Donetsk in Ukraine. So Khrushchev, I think he's like ethnically Russian, but a large part of his childhood and even his adult life he spent in the Ukraine.
This is that real sexy part of Ukraine where the Russians just took it back and nobody did anything about it.
Nobody said shit for about 50 years, and then shit popped off again. So Yuzovka, Donetsk, was a mining town at the time, and Khrushchev, he begins working, and it's going through this huge industrial boom at the time, but they're also very poor working conditions, and this results in like frequent strikes and the emergence of class consciousness, as you've got all the proletariat starting to realize, like, hey, we're being exploited by these foreign corporations, because some of them were German-owned.
Okay.
What do they have over us? We should all band together and seize the means of production. We need to do our own thing.
Yeah.
We know better than they do.
I mean, yeah, man. Yeah, you got to seize those means. That's what I'm doing right now.
You got to seize those means,
I'm taking over,
man.
This podcast. It's just going to be me, and Henry's going to be working
for me. You launching a coup?
Yeah, I'm launching a coup.
Okay.
Yeah, man. Look, I put a lot of work into this podcast, and by a lot of work, I mean 43% of the work.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Thanks, man. But we all kind of see where this is headed, you know, of the and especially with like the Russian Revolution. That's the problem, is that there's so much history in this guy that we don't even get to talk about, because we just have to. But anyway, 1915 to 1917, he's being radicalized. He's speaking out against the working conditions that all the proletariat and all the laborers are going through. He's like organizing strikes against the mine owners and the Russian government, because, you know, World War I is going on right now. And then in February of 1917, you've got the abdication of Tsar Nicholas II and the onset of the Russian Revolution, which is what...
Go ahead.
I was just saying, it just turns the whole world upside down.
You know, communism feels different when it comes out of a mine. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It feels
real.
It feels very...
That's back to the roots, you know? Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, this is bullshit.
I can't deny it when it comes out of, you know, this is that time, I think, you know, in Das Kapital and, you know, a lot of Marx writing, like, it's built for these industrial places, and it's built for this time, and people saw it, and they're coming out of it. And Russia was a perfect example and a perfect start to this thing.
Yeah, and just the idea of like, okay, we're gonna throw a revolution. I might die. I might get killed by government troops, but I'm already dying a slow death just breathing in all these fucking chemicals and fumes. And I'd almost rather just get shot in the name of some higher cause than just die 5 years from now with like a big wheezing.
You know what I mean?
You know, you can hear that rattling when they breathe, yeah, type shit, and you're just like, yeah, you know what, fucking kill me now, and maybe my death will bring about some greater change that more people can live a better life. Let's just fucking do it. You know, this is bullshit.
This is like, and Ukrainian miners are an extremely hardy bunch, particularly just because, like, they were, like, and you see, like, Chernobyl, like, the naked miners, the miners used to mine naked. No, there's some reason.
I haven't seen
this. There's some, like, miners in Ukraine that, like, just mine naked, which I don't understand why. Right, I think it had something to do with the radiation, or they just, like
probably
doing it.
Yeah.
Like, imagine, coming to fucking tell somebody, yo, you got to work another 8 hours, and his fucking dick is out, and he's covered in fucking smut from coal, and he's just, like, and he's just, and he's Ukrainian. That's how you get
murdered. He's just rubbing the side of the walls, like, the mine is my wife.
Yeah, no, he's been
fucking married to the mine. Yeah, we have good, real good sex, real rocket sex, you know? It's real nice.
He got sex with that mine.
Yep.
It's not a fun time.
It's pretty crazy, you know? You go crazy breathing all those fumes, you know?
It's procreation.
You go a little crazy.
It's procreation, not for fun.
No. I gotta impregnate the mine so we can get more coal, you know?
Yeah.
Like, all right, dude, cool, whatever prevents you from striking. So late 1918 to early 1919, Nikita Khrushchev is mobilized in the Red Army.
Yeah.
So he's initially, like, heading a battalion, but he quickly gets a political position. I think he was, like, a political instructor for the Ninth Army. I don't know exactly what that means. I didn't have time to go into the intricacies of early Russian bureaucracy, so it's on record.
That one guy who's like, yo, fuck you guys, that's what I came to this podcast for. Yo, fuck you too, son.
Yep. In 1922, Nikita Khrushchev and his family, they had to flee Yuzovka for a little bit because there was this Cossack general, I don't remember his name, he was like on the march, and so they had to flee the area. But 1922, they return, and it's almost completely destroyed, and the Russian Revolution is over, Bolsheviks have triumphed, and, like, post-war diseases are surging around the region.
If there's a couple of periods that, like, of Russian history, I'm afraid of all of Russian history, but, like, after World War One, and then after the fall of the Iron Curtain, like, after the Soviet Union disappeared, those are two periods where, like, these people are living the roughest lives that you've ever seen in your life, and there's a lot of murder, and like World War II, you're dying for a cause, all that type of shit. You know, he gets bullets, he gets a gun. You know what I mean? We've all played Call of Duty.
Yep.
Our Medal of
Honor. We've been there.
You know what I mean?
You know,
but like,
we know the struggle.
This is just like the insanity of just after World War One and after the Soviet Union.
Brutal.
Insane period.
Yeah. Brutal. And so, in response, in order to kind of build up the new Soviet economy, Russia adopts the NEP, which is the New Economic Program, which is kind of liberal for communism in that it's like adopting capitalist reforms. And so they allow peasants to sell their excess grain on the market, and they allow, like, limited foreign investment. So just shit that, like, Marx would be like, whoa, what the fuck are you doing? They're like, no, we need to allow some elements of capitalism just to make sure that we actually have an economy.
Yeah, well, they're like, you have to slide into communism. You just can't just go raw,
yeah,
raw dick communism.
You can't just flip the switch.
Yeah,
you can't raw dog communism.
Yeah, that's gonna fucking,
you know?
You're going to end up with the disease. That's how that works. You
yeah,
gotta
it's,
fucking,
it's, it, yeah.
You know what I mean? You gotta kind of figure out a place that works for
ease
your society. Ease it in. You know
baby
I mean?
Steps.
Baby step it.
You know?
We're gonna see.
It's like
a little bit later when somebody tries to fucking just flip the switch on economy and fucking kills millions of people.
Boom. It's like easing your girlfriend into a threesome. You know, you gotta introduce it step by step by step. Do it subtly, do it gradually to where she doesn't even know that it's happening.
Okay,
right?
One, you've said a lot of questionable shit on this podcast already. She needs to know that. That's first. We don't play down hard fight history. All I just right. turned to the camera that's not there, and I just said that. Two, fucking, lay man, if anything, my girl is going to lead me into a threesome. And hopefully, and I will hope that's with another woman. I will cry if it's with another man.
Hey, there you go. Hey, I didn't say whether it was another man or another woman. I want that to be clear. Okay, in case you people assumed that about me. All right,
now that sounds like gang rape. Because she doesn't know the two dudes. Mm. That just sounds like a lot over there.
No, that's not. I'm saying, you know. Slide up on my butt. Slide up on that booty. Okay. All right.
All right.
I just lost some people. Yeah,
yep, they're gone.
What are these guys doing? Ain't coming back. All right. So August of 1922, Khrushchev enrolls in the Workers' Training Program, which is the RABFAK. And it's basically, it's kind of like it's like getting your associates before you go into a technical institute. The technical institute would be the Donetsk Mining Technical College, or the Technikum. So you go RABFAK and then Technikum. But very quickly, he's named party secretary of the RABFAK and then the Technikum. And so his duties to the party and building up the party start to eclipse his education, but he's still climbing the Soviet bureaucracy. And this is something that like haunts him for the rest of his life, to where he always wanted to be a member of the intelligentsia, but he like never had the time to be able to like to fulfill that dream, because he was always wrapped up in the day-to-day operations of the state. So on January 21st of 1924, this is when you have the death of Lenin and the imminent secession crisis. You've got factionalism in the Bolshevik leadership. So initially, it's Stalin, this guy Lev Kamenev, and Zinoviev versus Trotsky, because Trotsky is a wild man.
Continual.
And then
revolution.
By 1926,
keep it going. Trotskyism, it is.
Yep.
Come on, dog. You know what I mean? I don't really.
My man tried.
I researched so much Trotskyism, and I don't know what the fuck it is. I keep looking at it, and I'm like, yo, what the fuck? I just know it's continual revolution, just continual fucking.
Kind of like Che, honestly. If I had to draw a parallel between, I think Trotsky and Che would have done wonders for the world. I'm more of a Bukharin man myself. Let me say that.
I don't even know
who
that
Bukharin
is. But doesn't Trotsky, wasn't Trotsky also like in mad orgies? He's like a ladies man or something.
I haven't heard that, but he had like that wild hair in the glasses.
Oh, it's
you know,
20s,
I just like his
fucking
hair,
you know,
to
mean?
Where it's like boom, you know, it's like a really cool do. So by 1926, the tables have turned entirely. It's become Kamenev, Zinoviev, and Trotsky versus Stalin. And behind all this, between 1925 to 28, Khrushchev, he's basically putting in his dues to the Communist Party. He's appointed party boss of a district in Stalino, which is the new name for Yuzovka, and then Kharkov, which is then the capital of Ukraine. And the NEP is doing pretty well. It's a new economic program or policy. It's doing pretty well. And Bukharin, who's my guy, Nikolai Bukharin, he's encouraging peasants to like enrich themselves, to revive agriculture and make sure that everybody has enough to eat by like incentivizing them. But this is reviving class tensions, because we hate the kulaks, which are like the rich peasants, and they're part of the reason that we launched this whole damn revolution, is because of class differences, and they're resurging.
Here's the thing. There's something very interesting about, like, I don't know if it's Eastern societies. Maybe it's because, you know, out there, like Russia, China, they have peasants, but they have these two classes of peasants. You got the rich peasants and the poor peasants. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, when I've read about this, I just go, but you niggas is all broke as fuck. But apparently, not really.
Mm-mm.
There's a group of people that are like, I'm doing pretty well in the system.
Yeah.
And then there's a group of people who are literally starving for their fucking lives.
Yeah, like eating cabbage water and hoping their sons make shoes when they grow up. Like that level of poverty. You're like, you need higher hopes. And so Khrushchev, he's doing what he can as party boss to revive coal production, because that's primarily what's coming out of the region. And like getting food and housing for his people. However, he's also like signing death warrants for counter-revolutionaries and kind of engaging in these preliminary party purges. So it's not all good what he's doing, and his hands are still dirty. end of 1928, he moves to Moscow to enroll in the Industrial Academy, and now he's closer to the seat of power, and he makes a name for himself purging the Industrial Academy of dangerous rightists, of all these, like, oh, these Bukharinists and these Trotskyites. Anybody who wasn't a Stalinist, he's like, you're not communist enough. And he's doing this in Moscow, and so the Kremlin takes note. They're like, hey, have you heard about this new young gun Khrushchev? Mm-hmm. He's doing all right. He's making a name for himself. You know, he's a rising star in the Soviet bureaucracy.
Yeah, I mean, it,
but he's like rising based on just killing all these other people, or at least like signing the death warrants or selling them out.
That's people never tell you that that's also a way to get the American dream, killing a lot of people.
That's you just kill everyone in your way. Anybody who you remotely perceive as competition, just fucking kill them.
Yeah, no,
and then
they never tell you about that's the way to accomplish your goals. Just murder people. Mm-mm.
This is
purge them out of the system. You know what I mean? Purge. Yep.
Maybe Khrushchev was more of a capitalist than he ever let on. You know?
Oh no, he wasn't. But
how's that hot take though? You know, that's going. It's all about the hot takes. So at the same time, Stalin announces the end of the new economic program. So to hell with all these capitalist reforms. Yeah. We got to get this communist revolution going. We got to build this utopian society. We have to collectivize.
Yeah.
And he collectivizes all the farms. He disenfranchises the middle class and like expropriates all this shit from the middle class and the kulaks and all the rich peasants, like takes their lands, takes their mechanical equipment, all that stuff. And this results in like another wave of strikes and protests and even an initial famine due to the, you know, they're still ironing out the kinks of collectivization and nobody has shit to eat, not even cabbage water.
I mean, it's a look, a lot of like the capitalist shit is like just based on like random fucking forecasting and these like complex guesses on how much shit we're gonna need. And when you transform your whole system, you don't fucking know anything because you never done it before. So mm-hmm. so you're gonna have a
and you're just taking stabs in the dark, like, yeah, maybe this will work. We just gotta try some
and
shit.
You
know? And if people die then you know.
Exactly. If you don't know what the fuck you're doing, it might work after a while. You might figure the kinks out.
Yeah.
But you're going to murder a lot of people for a good amount of time.
In the process. Yeah. Yeah. And then you get into like deontology, to where do the ends justify the means, or should you not even try if it involves all this? I can't say either way. I'm not going to say. Who can? Though also, you know, that's nuts.
I mean that's a deeper conversation about like how you feel, like how you view the world and what actually is a good life and all that type of stuff. And we don't have time for that. We gotta get through Khrushchev.
We can't get into that. So 1930 to 1931, Moscow, just a little context on Moscow itself, is divided into 10 different districts. And during those 2 years, Khrushchev is made party boss of, at first it's like the smallest district, and then he does well, and then he's made party boss of the biggest district. And while, you know, those 2 years, basically all he's doing is just purging those rightists mm-hmm. and filling those agricultural quotas and just, you know, purging it up, you know, because that's how you rise. You kill everybody who's in your way or anybody you have a remote suspicion about, because the Kremlin, Stalin is expecting you to. He's like, if you don't purge enough rightists, I will purge you. And you're just like, holy shit, live or die.
I mean, it's you know, ideological purity is rewarded. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of brings me back to a little Maoist principle of, you know, if you're not right, you shouldn't speak.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm.
It just depends on who decides who's right.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's very problematic. Also, I fuck with it. You know?
It's the actual quote, I think, is, if you don't know anything, you shouldn't speak. And it's just like, I don't know if you're wrong or something. It's like, oh man, that's a good ass principle. oh, man, well, that has a lot of pitfalls.
But that's there's a huge mine that you're about to step on by advocating. There's a huge problem with that, but also you're not wrong. Yeah. You know, it's a weird thing. Yeah. And so during that same time, the first 5-year plan has been put into place. I think with the elimination of the NAP, they announced the first 5-year plan, and these quotas are nearly impossible to meet. And the responsibility for unfulfillment ultimately falls on the district party leader, who in this case is Khrushchev. Mm-hmm. So he's taking all this flack. And then like the failure, they're like excessively high quotas accompanied with the failure to collectivize, quote unquote, properly, results in the Great Famine of 1932 to 1933. And it's bad for everyone, but it like heavily affects Ukraine almost more than anywhere else. And Bukharin's over here, he warned against coerced collectivization. And so it results within Russia itself, it results in the emergence of like a rightist Bukharinist opposition. And Stalin senses this, and he's like, you know what? It's time for another goddamn party purge, baby. Let's make it happen, you know?
I mean, that's basically, you could basically mark the years by like, yo, has there been a purge? Yeah, we haven't. It hasn't been a new year yet. Like, it's just always
we're overdue. It was always purging. And they get even worse with the December 1st of 34. You've got the assassination of this guy Kirov in Leningrad. And after this, there's rumors that Stalin might have arranged for the assassination of Kirov, but it's the same thing with like Castro arranging for Che's assassination. There's always some deeper conspiracy behind all this stuff. But after his death, Stalin authorizes like another wave of party purges, and like any unsolved quote unquote counter-revolutionary crime was solved in that you kill the suspect. Yeah. Whoever you have on hand who might have done it, fucking kill him. And this is when they start like setting quotas. From 34 to 37, you've got the show trials and just the Great Terror. Yeah. Like, this is where you hear all the horror stories in Russia of purges on purges on purges, torturings to coerce concessions, public executions and firing squads, and just a massive witch hunt. And
there are a few places Khrushchev that I don't want to go. Slavery times, of course, I'm black.
Uh-huh.
1980s. Just not feeling it. Too much grease in people's hair. You know what I mean?
It's a little weird.
1934 through 37 in Germany or Russia. Either one of those.
Yep.
Nope. You know what I mean?
You've got fascism on the left and fascism on the right, but in two different parts of the globe. It's a really weird thing.
And this is the time in 1934 through, I think, in the 30s, when they do so much purging that they kill so many of their like officers and shit in the army.
Yeah.
So that when they fucking get invaded by the Nazis, they get absolutely slaughtered because they have nobody who's ever, they don't. There's nobody who's like really knows how to do anything tactically.
You killed all your experts. Yeah. And then it's like, well, why are we being conquered so easily? And it's like, well, all the people who knew anything are dead because we thought they were rightists, but they were just educated. But it's like, oh, but education is a class thing, and we're not about classes anymore, so we need to kill all the educated people. And it's like,
this is when he's just killing randomly. I think there's a purge of like Jewish people. I think like anybody.
There were pogroms going on.
It's the insanity.
It's a shit show. And so in the midst of all this, in June of 37, the Politburo announced they set an enemy quota for Moscow at 35,000, and that we have to kill 35,000 rightists or we have not done our job. Yeah. And it's like, maybe there's not 35,000. To set a quota for something like this, it's almost like setting a quota for the amount of people that cops need to arrest or the amount of crime that cops need to report in the U.S. in order to justify their jobs, is maybe there's not that amount of crime.
I don't think that
it's a slippery slope.
It's not a slippery slope. They're at the bottom of it. It's fucking like 30. You're just setting 35,000 people that need to be killed. Like, and it's just a terror tactic. You're just trying to make sure fucking everybody knows if you're going against us, but also if you're not telling us about other people that are going against us, You're done. You're done. You're going to Siberia if you're lucky. That's if you're lucky.
If you, yeah, and you're gonna bust up rocks for the rest of your fucking life.
Yeah.
If you're fortunate. Like it's messy. And Khrushchev is just as complicit in all of this. Like, he's one of the guys preparing and signing the lists of people who, quote-unquote, like, deserved the death penalty. And in January of 37, he actually calls for people to, quote-unquote, educate the masses in hatred for the enemy. Like, he's full-on in favor of the purges.
Yeah, man, well, you got it. You gotta get some blood on if you get some blood on everybody's hands and they're all responsible for purging, then you're fucking. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You get everybody's got blood on their hands. They're not gonna. It's they have to start rationalizing it. It's like why we're doing this. Well, I also did this, so I'm guilty in this. So now we go together hand in hand forward to a new day.
It's almost like a solidarity of a shared secret, but it also like bothers Khrushchev, and we're gonna talk in the next episode about like. How it affects him and how it hits his psyche. But at this point, like there's an element of dog eat dog. Like I need to prepare and sign these lists because if I don't, I'm going to be labeled an oppositionist and I'm going to be killed and I don't want to die. And it's, you know, survival of the fittest almost, but it's fucking brutal.
Yeah.
And so 38 to 39, you've got Khrushchev. He's in Kiev, which is now it's the capital of Ukraine. I don't know if it was then. I don't think it was. I think it was still, the other place we mentioned earlier. So he's appointed chair of the Central Control Commission in Ukraine. And he's initially got this policy of Ukrainianization, which is he'd promote like Russian communism through local customs and languages. But this results in like the emergence of some nationalist groups. And so they've got this shift back towards Russification, which they like rewrite the history books in like schools and stuff to emphasize Russo-Ukrainian cooperation.
Yeah.
Or cooperation, rather.
Yeah.
September of 1939, you got the outbreak of World War II. Hitler invades Poland. However, the previous month, Russia and Germany signed the Non-Aggression Pact, and they agreed to partition Poland. And so in the early war, the USSR, they, like, with the outbreak of the war, Hitler's going east, and so they've almost got, like, a free hand in the West. USSR, they start to expand into Eastern Europe. They hit Bessarabia in Romania, Belarusia, and Finland. And Nikita Khrushchev's role is Sovietizing the newly acquired Western Ukraine because they had Eastern Ukraine, but they didn't have the West quite yet. And they're doing all right for a little bit until June 22nd of 41, Hitler decides to invade the USSR. And they're massively unprepared. Because just like you said, they killed all of their army officers and all their experts and all the people who would have known how to defend Russia from the German onslaught. It's like, I don't know, boss. They're all dead because you said they were all Bukharinist, non-communist, capitalist spies.
Now they're murdered.
And so we shot them all. Yeah, and now we're getting shot by somebody else.
We're getting shot by some guy named Fritz. from Munich, like that's like.
that's how it works, you know. Fritz is fucking cleaning up right now, and so Khrushchev, like during World War II, he's actually at Stalingrad in August of 1942. That's the start of Stalingrad, which is now Volgograd, but it was Stalingrad. Yeah. And Khrushchev, he was in charge of liaisoning with like the top generals around the area and reporting what they said back to the Kremlin over in Moscow. And so he's going back and forth. The thing about Stalingrad is that it is vital. Like just geographically, it connects the southern provinces of the USSR, including the oil-rich Caucasus, with Russia proper, like western Russia, where you've got Moscow and like the most concentrated amount of cities. And if you take Stalingrad now, you've not only cut off their oil supply, but you can then invade the heartland of Russia. And you know, you've got these other guys in the Kremlin who are like going over to Stalingrad and basically taking photo ops on the front lines with these other people, but also checking up on Khrushchev to see how he's doing. So November of 42, Soviets start to push back the German assault at Stalingrad, and then from there, momentum gathers. You know, they start to push the Germans out of Russia. You've got Kursk, and then Kiev is liberated by the end of 1943, and the tide starts to turn against Germany.
I mean,
so from
if you We always do, like, we celebrate, like, what, D-Day every day, every year. There's like a celebration of D-Day. And honestly, like, if we want to talk about what won this war, it was, like, Stalingrad.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Putin.
I think.
No, but Putin did something, like, recently where it was, like, he was just talking about the only time, like, we were talking about, like, just Russians sacrifice in World War II and, like, what really kept us, like, away from all just being Nazi slaves. And it was Russians. No doubt.
It was us. No. It was us, you fucking asshole. No. Like,
Wait, who?
I found...
It was who? It was Russia.
It was the Reds.
Yeah, okay.
It was the Reds.
Okay, just making sure.
It was the Reds, goddammit.
27 million of them.
I read...
Fucking dead.
There was Yeah, 27 million. That was a statistic... Yeah. I think that's like combined civilians and military, yeah. But they also don't tell you that when Hitler was in the bunker, I don't remember where he was in that bunker when he finally, like him and Eva Braun finally killed himself. It was actually in the wake of Russian troops under this guy Zhukov, who is like one of Khrushchev's contemporaries. Is like the Russians were actually the one invading that city, and Hitler was like, ah, fuck.
Yeah.
Gigs up. No. I gotta blow my brains out. But it wasn't like USA rolling through there. It was the Russians.
No, General Zhukov, when he got there, like people don't understand, like when the Russians got to Germany, German troops would run to surrender to American troops because they were like, no, because the Russian, that front on the east was like I don't think we'll ever see. I hope to God we'll never see anything like that. But it's
hell yeah.
It's rape, murder, pillage, destroy, hundreds of thousands of dead people.
Yeah.
It's millions of dead bodies like stacking.
Yeah,
like it's insanity.
So from 1944 to 1946, Khrushchev is head of the Ukrainian government, and he's in charge of rebuilding Ukraine, which is absolutely ravaged, you know, so he's got to rebuild the collective farms. He's got to re-stimulate the economy, which is like mostly coal again, and also crush nationalist guerrilla uprisings. The most prominent one in Ukraine at this time is the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, OUN. And there's kind of this emergence of nationalist consciousness in Ukraine at the time, because for the most part, it had always been occupied by another foreign power. And all of a sudden in the wake of, you know, you got the end of World War II, and all of a sudden Ukraine is like, why can't we be our own sovereign province? Just like so many of the, just like Angola and all sorts of places that would, you know, it's just the new world.
People look at when Ukraine kind of had those protests with those 2014.
And
fucking everybody was like, Obama supported the protesters, and people were like, some of those dudes are fucking Nazis. That kind of goes back to this period. Some of those people, Ukrainian nationalism is heavily tied into fighting the Russians, into fighting communism, all type of stuff. So, i.e., who fought the Nazis?
It makes sense that it would be if they're anti-communist and they're anti-left.
Yeah.
They would be right.
They'd be right.
You know,
they would be with these
right wing. That's what I mean.
Yeah, they'd be right wing, and then they would identify with these Ukrainian national groups that were Nazi sympathizers. So the identifying part is that's, you know, Ukrainian nationalism is somewhat tied to like old Nazi sympathy groups, sympathizers. So yeah, it's a very interesting turn. Interesting part.
We can say some, not all, but then in 24, in 24, you also have all that shady shit going on with Manafort and Gates and Giuliani, the man himself, to where they had their own hand in Ukraine, and nobody really knows what their role was. And so Khrushchev, he's up against pretty formidable opposition in rebuilding the economy, because most of his laborers have been killed. Like the massive conscriptions that they had to implement during the war, leave only like old men and children to become laborers. But despite this opposition, he actually ends up doing really well. Like, he raises coal output and agricultural yields, which he doesn't raise them to exactly what they were pre-war, but the rate by which he increased them is impressive given the extent of the destruction. Yeah. However, on the opposite side, in regard to the OUN, Khrushchev was also in charge of like overseeing and supervising the secret police, and at one point he advocates like public hangings after tribunals instead of private shootings. Like, let's send a message, yeah. You know. So there was still blood on his hands in crushing these guerrilla uprisings. It wasn't all good, but in Stalin's eyes, it was. You know,
in Stalin's eyes, a lot of things are good. Yeah, you know I mean,
yeah, Stalin's a fucked up guy. he was a So in July of 1946, Moscow raises agricultural quotas despite Khrushchev's concerns, and Khrushchev basically says that these quotas, they're not based in fact, they're not realistic at all, they're not based on how much can be feasibly produced by any given province or district, they're based on how much can be extorted mm-hmm. and funneled to the top. Yeah. And so in 46 to 47, you've got widespread famine in Ukraine, probably in Russia as well. And there's like horror stories of just cannibalism in the countryside and parents eating their children. And just they would find like heads and feet under bridges, but like no corpse. Wow. And the implication being that they just didn't want to eat the head or the feet, but they ate everything else because there was nothing else to eat. So from 47 to 52, these are the waning years of Stalin. He's in poor health, he's senile, he's on his way out, and he's spending a lot of time at his dacha, which is like a countryside, like a country, basically you know, Stalin's Mar-a-Lago. He's always there.
Mar-a-Lago. 5 years of Spanish didn't right. pay off yeah, that yeah. well. Jesus Christ.
Mar-a-Lago. Not right then. Mar-a-Lago. No, I just fucked Mar-a-Lago.
Mar-a-Lago.
Up. I was thinking Lago. I know Lago, like lake. Lake and sea. But yeah, I misspoke. So everyone around Stalin is kind of maneuvering for that top spot. And Stalin, he's summoning all of his cronies around him, basically just to hang out with him. And this includes Khrushchev. And they're all like binge drinking and playing mean pranks on each other. And Stalin's like pressuring people to drink more than they should. And they like watch a lot of Westerns. They're like super into Westerns for some reason. And just being mean. It reminds me of like a really petty 10-year-old's birthday. Have you seen this episode of The Twilight Zone?
No.
Where it's like this kid.
Wait, I said no got, before I haven't seen it. Wait, to describe it to me.
There's this kid, and he's like a 7-year-old kid, and every day is his birthday in like rural Iowa, and everybody, he can like read your thoughts.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
That one, and if you don't do exactly what he says, he will fucking banish you to hell or wherever, to the alternate dimension of horrors. That's what Stalin in his final years reminds me of, because it's like he's really petty and he will kill you on a whim.
Yeah.
Like, he will take everything the wrong way just for an excuse to kill you because he wants you to like him. And I don't know. It just all struck me as very, very weird.
Do you think that it's interesting watching Westerns? Do you think? What do you think? Do you have an idea of like what that was about?
Why?
Because I'm always going back to like the kind of there's like an American ideology about Westerns of being the outsider, mm-hmm. the lone person, right? The cowboy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm trying to see how that plays in, because the cowboy is such an individualistic type character. It'd be odd. In a communist context. But maybe they just like the movies, or it kind of represents.
I was thinking that,
or it's how they feel on a global context. They feel like the outsider, and they feel like the one, the hunted one, or the one that's doing the good at the end of the day.
The outlaw, the outlaw in pursuit of the higher truth. Yeah. Maybe, I didn't really think about it. Maybe they just didn't have any movies. They had propaganda films, but like, come on, you don't want to watch your own propaganda films, sometimes do you? You want to watch something else.
Sometimes they're fucking dank, man.
Sometimes they're, you know what I mean? Want to see how they came
out. Sometimes you're fucking pretty goddamn good.
So Stalin, he's frequently summoning Khrushchev to come and dine with him. And at this point, Stalin's memory is failing him, which is super useful to have his ear. Because basically, if you're dining with him and Stalin forgets something, you can basically put ideas in his head and turn other rivals for that top spot against... You know, you can turn Stalin against them. Okay. So Khrushchev's over here like, no, it wasn't. I didn't ever say anything bad about your new shoes. I love your new shoes. That was Kuznetsov who said something bad about your shoes, man. You remember Kuznetsov. You should kill Kuznetsov. And he's like, oh, yeah, it was him.
Fucking the senile Stalin sounds like the worst grandpa ever.
Yeah, man. he was a handful. Except he didn't have diapers, I don't think. Not like my grandpa. Yeah.
You just made everybody sad. Move on.
So on March 5th of 1953, Stalin finally dies of complications after a heart attack, I should say. And this is where we get into like that movie, The Death of Stalin. It's a lot like that. And you've got who's going to be the next top dog. There's these three guys, Malenkov, Lavrenty Beria, and Khrushchev. They all have a prior alliance, and they kind of become this like leading triumvirate. So Malenkov, he's in charge of the party personnel, and Beria is in charge of the chief, or he's the chief of the secret police. Yeah. Just a super scary guy. Like, he would like drug women and rape them and killed more than any other top Kremlin guys. He was a freaking monster. Yeah. And Khrushchev, he chaired the Moscow party. He had one of the four Central Committee secretaries, another of which was Stalin, and one of the 11 Politburo chairs. So he's more like hitting the bureaucratic angle, but he's still like a key player in all this. Okay. And so what's crazy is just like the trifecta that's going on, and that Khrushchev, he has to befriend Beria and Malenkov, knowing that he would eventually have to betray them for that top spot. And Beria and Malenkov knew the exact same thing. Yeah. And so it's very sharky, you know. It's basically like Khrushchev would go to Beria and be like, hey, we should join together to overthrow Malenkov. But then Khrushchev would also go to Malenkov and be like, hey, we should join together to overthrow Beria. But then Beria and Malenkov were talking and be like, hey, we should join together to overthrow Khrushchev. And so it's like, where is this going to end up? You know, the balance of power cannot be maintained this way. Somebody has to be number one.
It's like a... Here's the thing about, like, when you create any type of new society or new platform of government, the most important time in that new government's life is the transition of power.
and
those are where the interesting things happen, and that's how you can tell if like a society or I think a government's really healthy, is how they transition power.
The peaceful, if it's peaceful or if it's super fucking bloody.
There's been a lot of fucking African countries that have had great things when they started off, great constitutions, great kind of like trying to build something that's more democratic, and then all of a sudden, it's time to transition power. You're looking at two terms. Yep. All of a sudden, the president's like, I'll stay in for a third, and everybody's like, wait, no, you're not supposed to do that.
I think I can do it. Everybody, your Constitution says that you can't write. It's like, I don't recognize the Constitution. Yep. I'm going to write my own, man. I can do better than that one. And it's like, Jesus.
Same thing kind of happens in Bolivia recently, where the kind of like socialist leader is like, yo, I think I'll try to stay in for a third. But then he's kind of cooed by some like far right wing Christians, and now those people are not allowing elections in Bolivia. They're like far right wing Christians. Mm-mm, yeah, yeah, nope. Yeah. It's a fun time going on in Bolivia.
Can't handle it, man. Can't handle it.
So that's
what
I'm saying.
That's one of the like the.
Go ahead.
That's one of the seminal moments in American history is the transition of power between John Adams to Jefferson. Mm-hmm. Is everybody thought like they handed off to Jefferson, there's going to be blood in the streets. Yeah. We're going to hit civil war. But it was like, it was astounding to the American public that they were like, holy shit, we can pass the baton peacefully, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, who knows this one, big dog? Who knows what, if you're listening to this in December of or 2021, any time past November of 2020, tell us how it turned out.
Let us know. Let us know. Because I am, this one's getting, I am scared.
Yeah, it's been real sketchy.
Yep. It's getting real, real bad. Real weird. So on March 5th of 1953, you've got a meeting of the Central Committee, and it's chaired by Khrushchev. And, you know, this is where you see the triumvirate in action. Beria nominates Malenkov to head the Soviet government, and Malenkov, in turn, says that Beria should chief the police, while Khrushchev, he would kind of effectively be stripped of some of his posts. He would step down as Moscow party leader to focus on a secretariat in the Central Committee. Yeah. So it's like, all right, that's cool. 4 days later, March 9th, you've got Stalin's funeral in the Red Square, and Mao is there to pay his respects. Malenkov replaces Stalin as prime minister, and he's chairing the meetings of the Politburo. But meanwhile, Beria is doing his own maneuvering. He becomes a reformer. Basically, he's starting to advocate for the release of like non-political prisoners in Siberia and all the gulags. And this is designed to take the heat off of him for being arguably the most complicit in the purges. He was, you know, chief of the secret police and just killing massive amounts and sanctioning the killings of massive amounts of people. And now that Stalin's dead, he's like, I didn't mean it. It's cool. Well, I didn't. Let's advocate for these reforms.
Well, I mean, that's politics.
That's smart government. That's
just politics. He's going to come out and he's going to say, hey, you know what I mean? Politics is the illusion around, like, the government provides. He's just saying, yo, I know I can get ahead of this and win the people's backing if all of a sudden I appear like, I didn't even want to fucking do that. It's all these fucking psychos back here.
Just throw everyone else under the bus. And he also starts to, like, bombard the Politburo with his proposals. So he's both, like, virtue signaling, basically, and flexing his top dog status. Yeah. And so Khrushchev, he doesn't like this. And so he starts flipping people against Beria. Like, first he approaches Malenkov and then the other guys. Voroshilov, Kaganovich, Molotov, and he tells Anastas Mikoyan, like, last minute, basically the day of the coup against Beria, he's like, hey, by the way, everyone else in the Politburo decided that we don't fucking like Beria anymore. So Khrushchev's coup, last thing we're going to talk about, happens on June 26th of 53, and Beria is arrested by Khrushchev's guys. So just kind of getting into the details of the coup, because it's actually a pretty interesting story. Beria, he was former chief of the secret police. He's in deep, like he's deeply protected.
Yeah.
Beria has two MVD divisions, which are the Ministry of Internal Affairs, in Moscow. He's in control of the Kremlin Guard, and he's the Moscow Military District Commander, who's this guy, Artemev, is former NKVD, and he like served under Beria.
Yeah.
But Khrushchev, he's got a war buddy in the Air Force, this guy Kiro Muskalenko, and they arrange for Beria's guy Artemev to be out of town on like a military inspection, and Khrushchev, he phones Muskalenko. He's like, yo, Muskalenko, get your boys on standby. You guys are going to await a summons to discuss, quote-unquote, air defense readiness, because they're Air Force guys.
Yeah.
And he tells them to bring, quote-unquote, cigars, which are weapons. But, you know, all the lines are tapped, and so they have to speak in code. And so the Khrushchev conspiracy, they call a meeting of the Politburo, the Presidium of the Council of Ministers, which is one place that Beria did not sit on. So Beria wouldn't be in the room, but he would have guys listening in the other room and be immediately notified of what they were doing. Yeah. Malenkov is the one who suggests removing Beria from his post, and they all assent, and they start lambasting Beria. He's a fucking monster. He's not communist enough, yada, yada. And then all of Khrushchev's guys start to file in to the Kremlin. Now, there's this idea of, or this, like, this counter-thought or this counter-argument that how did Beria allow this to happen? Surely he would have known that something was in the works, word gets around, and he's in deep with all these guys, and he's got ears everywhere. One explanation of that is that he thought the coup was going to happen against Malenkov, and he was told that by Khrushchev, and Khrushchev was just playing them both off of each other. Yeah. But Khrushchev knew that Beria was a real threat because he had all these military connections. Yeah. And so Khrushchev like faints toward one direction, but then ends up getting Beria out of there. Wow. And so the lesson from all this is that sometimes it pays to be the second choice. Like, nobody likes the guy who was first in line. Yeah. And the guy who gets the position first isn't always there for long.
Yeah.
You know?
Spoken like a true person who really has hated on somebody from right behind them.
She son of a bitch, just you wait.
Just you wait. I'm gonna get you out of here. I'm gonna plant some kitty porn on this guy. I don't have kitty porn. I just want to make that clear. Ah, damn it.
Did it again. A lot of mind stepped on in this episode.
A lot of minds.
But yeah, I just wanted to, now Khrushchev's on top. He's got to still kind of like consolidate his hold on power, but he's got it. For our purposes, from this point out, he's top dog.
Okay.
And we're going to see what his image of the world looks like in the next episode.
Okay. All right, sounds good. We're going to hit the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's going to be a fun time.
Mm-hmm.
The 50s mm-hmm. in Russia, also going to be a fun time.
Not for the Russians.
It's never been fun in Russia for the Russians. I was being liberal with the term of the use, fun, for the term of the word fun. There's nothing ever been fun. All right, Henry, give him your social media.
You can find me Henry E. Price or just Henry Price on Facebook.
Gonna be Joshua B. Stokes on Instagram and Twitter. Joshua Stokes on Facebook. Guys, find us at Hard Fart History on Instagram and Facebook, and find us at HFH Podcast on Twitter. Guys, thank you for listening. We'll see you next time for part two and the conclusion of our man.